'Tis true, 'tis pity, 'tis silly, 'tisn't true. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with us today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good and jovial today friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Wow, that's an interesting opening. That's all I got to say.
Well, and we're going to look at it in reverse order today, Chuck, because, yes, I like quoting and paraphrasing the bard sometimes. That comes from Shakespeare, ladies and gentlemen. Tis true, tis pity, we'll talk about later. Tis silly, tisn't true, we're going to talk about right now. Chuck and I have been having a little fun this week, ladies and gentlemen. We've been kind of looking around the blogosphere and around the internet and around the block and around our backs and looking for the knife in the middle of them. But we've been finding some things out there that we just had to go put together as a compilation today. And we're kind of calling it Notes from the Silly File. Because a lot of the stuff that we're going to be talking about is absolutely, well, 110% boneheaded. The problem is, it's stuff that an elementary school child would know better. But the people who are saying these things are your elected officials. That should give us all a little bit of pause right there. Now, granted, you know, I know that really, Chuck, none of this ever happens in any of our own backyards because our guys are all great.
Yeah, right.
And it's always somebody else's. And of course, we've got some particular violators that we're going to be talking about today. But really, you know, I hate to paraphrase Hillary Clinton, but it does take a village, and it takes a village to get rid of an ignorant and obnoxious congressperson.
Well, yeah. There's also the you left out part of that, and that sometimes it takes a village idiot.
It does. Well, we got
yeah.
There are those in abundance. I hate to say it right now.
Yes, and a lot of them sit as representatives in the House, the Senate, the State House, the State Senate, the governorship,
the chief executive of the United States. Yeah. Well, you know, we go around and on that, but. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, we hope we're going to have a little bit of fun today. But there is some serious side to it, and that's the reason why the true thing is a pity. Because, you know, as Chuck and I work out here in the communities and across the state, trying to bring some measure of constitutional awareness and constitutional thinking back into our public discussion, we sometimes have to just shake our head because, you know, I think, Chuck, a lot of people, especially those who like the way things are now, would call us idealists. I mean, they could use other terms like extreme. And let's see, what was it John Boehner said? Oh, yeah, we can't say that on air because it was a bad word.
Yeah.
Well, let's put it this way. It was like the biblical allusion to a donkey. But
yeah.
But.
Well, that's
really,
not actually a bad word.
Well, it's not. But we'll just for sake of the radio station, we won't say it. But what we do get called are being idealistic or not working in reality, that somehow saying that there are absolute standards, saying that the actual words of a document mean specific things, somehow makes us outside the mainstream. And you know what? Honestly, Chuck, it's true. But it's not the way it should be because, again, we are supposed to be a nation of rule of law and a country that is based upon certain principles that we have seen, at least in the modern era, are being willfully abandoned as fast as possible by both major parties. Yeah, we're bipartisan. We're going to say this program's not all going to be attacking one particular party.
No,
it's going to be attacking both. And we do attack. That's true. But we attack with things that we can document because everybody has opinions. But our opinions really don't matter much unless we can point to something that is firm and absolute and say, this is the way we're supposed to be operating. That's what we try to teach in our classes. Your opinions, what you think, you feel, you believe, and you hope Well, that's great, and those are wonderful for you personally, but when it comes to engaging civically, they really don't matter that much because everybody, including the elected officials who you're probably complaining to, have opinions as well, and to them, they think, they hope, they feel, and they believe something totally radically different than you. So then who's right? Might make right? Are we living in Darwin's world where survival of the fittest, might makes right, red in tooth and claw, and since they hold power, i.e., they're the office holder, then their definitions are the right ones and yours are wrong? Well, that's usually the way it works out because usually a lot of citizens get ignored by their elected officials when they say, I don't like what you did because I feel or I believe right. or whatever. But then when you start going to an elected official and saying, you were wrong because you swore an oath to this document and this document clearly says here, here, and here, you can't do that. Now we're talking something different. Now, the big problem, though, Chuck, and this is what we're going to get into for our opener, we have to understand the document we're talking about. We also have to understand how long that document has been around.
That's right. Well, first of all, let's go with that how long it's been around thing, because this one really, when I saw this yesterday, I just was like, oh my gosh. There is a representative who represents the Houston, inner city.
It's the 18th district in Texas.
Right.
Congressional district.
And unfortunately, this woman is a repository of misinformation.
Shall we say creative truth? or as our friend Mike Peruca likes to say, it isn't what you don't know.
That isn't so.
It isn't what you don't know that's the problem. It's what you do know that just ain't so.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
It's what you know that just ain't so, which is Mark Twain.
Mark Twain, that's right. Yeah, Mike Peruca paraphrases it. But U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee from Houston, Texas embodies that quote.
ladies and gentlemen, if this were just a one-off mistake, it would be one thing. But Sheila Jackson Lee has a bag full.
Oh, she has a penchant for misstatement.
For instance, because she's from Houston, and the NASA has a control. If you remember Houston, we have a problem.
Right.
Well, one of NASA's main control headquarters is in Houston. So when the Mars rover was launched and it was making contact with Houston, she went for a tour and got invited in to see what they could see from the Mars rover.
From the video feed, yeah.
So basically they were controlling it by remote control. Now, of course, Mars is very far away, so you send it a signal and you have to wait till the signal gets there, which takes a few minutes.
For the video signal to get back that it's actually doing what you told it to do.
Exactly. So basically, Sheila Jackson Lee asked the controllers to, quote-unquote, drive over to where the astronauts left the flag.
Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. According to Sheila Jackson Lee's understanding, our mission wasn't to the moon, it was to Mars.
To Mars, yeah.
Now, I wonder if while she was there, she found John Carter and Little Green Men and all that other good stuff.
Or Robinson Crusoe on Mars, yeah, the little monkey. Yeah.
I can even forgive her for that, for not knowing her galaxies and her constellations and, I don't know, a little piece of history about the U.S. landing men on the moon instead of on Mars. But I think this one that we've dug up here, the most recent one, I'm not sure how forgivable this really is because, again, like I said, I think this is something that an elementary school child would get more closer to correct.
This woman has a degree in political science from Yale and a law degree from the University of Virginia, neither of which are noted for turning out normally bad students.
No, right. They're both high-end schools.
They're high-end schools. Okay. Sheila Jackson Lee, I believe yesterday, basically said, maybe I should offer a good thanks to the distinguished members of the majority, talking about the Republicans.
She's a Democrat.
She's a
Houston.
Democrat. The Republicans, my chairman and others, for giving us an opportunity to have a deliberative constitutional discussion that reinforces the sanctity of this nation and how well it is that we have lasted some 400 years operating under a constitution that clearly defines what is constitutional and what is not. In other words...
Okay. Now, you know what, ladies and gentlemen? we're going to go along with the writers from the Washington Free Beacon, which is the blog site of a newspaper that we pulled this from. But this was recorded live on C-SPAN when she was standing giving the speech. Okay, Sheila Jackson Lee may believe that we've been operating under a constitution for 400 years. There's only a slight problem with that, yeah. Charles. If you start doing the math, that puts us back to about 1614. Now, you and I, when we teach our classes, we do start pretty early in discussing constitutional law and constitutional sure. adherence, because we do go back into the 1600s. We even go farther back than that. We go back to the age of discovery and exploration as these concepts were coming across. But the Constitution itself was written in 1787, not 1614, right. and ratified by its own procedure in 1789. Now, that leaves us, again, with about 173 years.
175.
175 yeah. when you only look at the ratification.
Because we're at 225 at this point.
Right.
And she's off by about 175 years.
Now again, I don't want people listening to us believing that we're cold-hearted and you know, we're just trying to drive an agenda. Because I will give you that if you read this a certain way, if you read her quam in a right. certain way, you could interpret it, if you're being very generous and you didn't know her background and her history of huge misstatements, that she was saying that, well, you know, around 400 years, and if you think about it, we did have, Jamestown was settled in 1607. So you're looking at 407 years from the settlement of Jamestown, which most people mark because the Roanoke adventure, they discount, and the Pilgrim's Landing at Plymouth was 1620.
Yeah.
Roanoke wasn't successful, and the Pilgrims didn't land until 1620, so Jamestown is the first permanent settlement in 1607. I can give her the fact that she's talking about this, that we've lasted for 400 years as a nation. However, the big problem is we weren't a nation, a full nation, until the Articles of Confederation in 1783, right? 1781.
Yeah, they started writing it in 77. It wasn't adopted until 1781.
81, right. Yeah, that's right.
Fully ratified.
So, but she was saying that we've lasted 400 years operating under a constitution. Well, not really. Now, was there was a royal charter for Jamestown? Sure. That wasn't a constitution. Was there a compact in Plymouth? Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, honestly, I wouldn't mind if we even went back to that, because I think we might get a few things right if we went back to that compact of the Mayflower Compact of 1620. We've had some others, Massachusetts Body of Liberties, the Connecticut Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. We've had the Virginia Declaration of Rights. You can go down and down.
Declaration of Independence.
Right. We've had state constitutions in numerous states, including South Carolina that John Locke wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania that was written by a committee that included Benjamin Franklin writing that constitution. And I'm trying to remember who else in Pennsylvania helped write that constitution. Okay.
Too long.
Anyhow, that's a homework assignment for our listeners.
There you go.
The key is, yes, folks, we have been operating under form of government. Now, if you want to say that from Jamestown until 1789 or 1781, we were operating under the English Constitution, yeah, you might argue that up to about 1776, but
right,
that's
right.
about it.
And in fact, I've made that argument because I've had people question when we get into these discussions on Article 5. And I bring up Anglo-American history, and people say, well, why bring English history into this? And I said, because their constitution was our constitution until 1776. That's why we fought a revolution, because the English government was violating the British constitution, which
right.
we were under.
Right, exactly. And so if I'm going to be horribly charitable, Chuck, I'm going to say that Sheila Jackson Lee, with a degree from Yale and a degree from University of Virginia Law, maybe just gets a little starstruck on the floor and she's not sure how to put a sentence together. Because I know a lot of attorneys and a lot of learned collegiate graduates who really can't do sentence construction or understand the basic rules of grammar very well. And we see that even in our classes when you start looking at the Constitution. Boy, I'll tell you what, if you don't know the basic rules of grammar, you can get lost really easily, like many of the people who are supporting an Article 5 convention do, when they mistake where the commas are and where the stops are in Article 5.
And in fact, someone just sent me an article that talks about Article 5, what it means based on the English grammar construction. And it's very clear from Article 5, and we've been saying this all along, and now we've basically got this grammatical construction interpretation that says the federal government is in charge, not the states.
Exactly.
And so that's the kind of mess you can get into. And yeah, some people don't speak well extemporaneously.
But Sheila Jackson Lee doesn't speak well
at any time.
Yeah. And really has some real, like, showstopper misstatements and, shall we say, unique to her truths.
So
I just thought that'd be kind of funny because, yes, the Constitution's not 400 years old, Congresswoman Lee.
But and the real sad part about this is,
yes,
this is the kind of person who votes on things that we're going to see coming up before the House.
Yes.
One of the things that I was taken aback by, because first of all, let's talk about this. Obama threatens vetoes of bills requiring him to follow the law. Now, the Constitution is very clear. The president is not only required to enforce the law, that implies, it's implicit in that he obey the law. He can't break the law to make law. And who do we know from the Constitution, Barry, makes law?
That's right. Wait a minute. It's Article 1, Section 1. All legislative authority herein granted is vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
So who makes law?
Congress.
Yes.
The legislative branch.
But we've got a president of the United States who makes statements like President Obama made yesterday. And when I say yesterday, that would be March the 12th.
Right. So we're recording this on Thursday
the 13th. He said, quote, "I don't have time to waste. The clock is ticking."
Yes. Yes, it is. It always is ticking. It started ticking at the beginning of time, and it will quit ticking at the end of time.
And it will stop ticking later. At God's discretion.
Yep.
But he knows that, this is a quote from this article from the Weekly Standard, "President Obama knows that his time is almost up." His time's almost up? He's got over 2 years left.
Right.
It's a point he's making to liberal Democratic donors to get them to donate generously in this year's midterm election. Okay, an analysis. What does this mean? If he's worried about the midterm election, what is he really worried about?
He's worried about his legacy. He's worried about being impotent in his last 2 years of being not a lame duck, but a cooked goose.
A cooked goose. Really, what he'll be is completely isolated because if the House
and the Senate
go over to the Republican Party, the fact is he will get nothing done.
And the recent special election, which happened earlier this week in Florida, that should have been a walk-in for the Democrats, with the Republican pulling off the win, has really taken the wind out of Democrat sails right now, because they are worried that not only can they not keep the bleeding from continuing in the House of Representatives, this may portend some really painful times come November in the U.S. Senate.
And that turned into something like 47-53.
It turned into an absolute beating.
It's 6 points.
Of the Democrat by the Republican, which wasn't supposed to happen.
Well, and we weren't going to go here, but I've looked at basically a couple of analysis, and they basically said he ran against immigration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Illegal immigration reform.
Which is interesting in that district in Florida, because there's a lot of Cuban immigrants there who do it legally.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the problem, I think. Barack Obama's got a real problem on his hands. Now, again, these were quotes he were giving to Democratic mega donors.
Right.
This was a $36,000 a person fundraiser event. Now, listen carefully to what he says. I'm going to quote this because you and I are both looking at the same article from the Weekly Standard blog by Daniel Halper. And he quotes, he says, Your quote, I don't have time to waste. This is Obama talking. The clock is ticking. There's less than 2 years left, less than 3 years left. So he stops himself when he realizes he's got more time. I want to squeeze every last little bit of work that I can during the remainder of my term so that looking back, I'm going to be able to say that we left everything on the field and every single person I could help in this office, which is such an incredible privilege, I helped. Okay, first of all, Charles, can you open up Article 2 of the Constitution?
Sure.
Can you tell me where in that Article 2 it has any kind of a statement remotely relating to the idea that the President of the United States' job is to help individuals with his policy decisions?
I don't.
Specifically?
I've gone through Section 1. Here's Section 2. Nope, nothing in there. Commander-in-Chief. Make treaties.
Now, who are this every single person he really wants to help? Let's just be politically realist about it, okay? We're not being idealists anymore here, ladies and gentlemen, so that charge is gone. Political realist. He's wanting to help the people who are writing him those $36,000 checks.
That's exactly what it is.
The people in the room. And what he's really telegraphing to them is, if you guys don't pony up and help us keep the Senate and try to take back the House, I'll try, because we know he's going to push as much of the radical socialistic changes to our country that you all want to see happen. And he says this. He's like, you know what? I think this is hilarious. He says, Democrats are not without flaws.
Okay,
that's good. That's good. We have our blind spots and we have our dogmas. And we got our crazy folks. Really? I guess those are the conservative Democrats who are pro-life and pro-gun, right? And anti-immigration.
Yellow dogs.
Yeah. That would be those 22 Democrats who came across the aisle and voted against the unlimited spending and the budget corrections piece.
If we were playing opposites.
Yes.
This would be the equivalent. Obama would be the equivalent of the Tea Party seizing control of the Republican Party. Again, we're playing opposites. And doing everything in their particular agenda by force, by presidential decree rather than using the legislature. What would happen if that happened? What would happen to that president in the press and in the legislature?
Well, in the legislature, the likelihood is that he would end up having articles of impeachment brought against him. But in the press, they would probably applaud him for taking decisive actions with a do-nothing Congress.
Not from the right.
Not from the right, but from the mainstream press, which to them is really all that's important. And so when he talks about this 2.5 years left, and that during the remainder of his term so that he can say, looking back, he helped people. Folks, that's legacy talk.
It's double speak.
I'm going to put a capstone on my career, and that capstone's going to be huge, and it's going to be very visible to everybody. Same thing every president tries to do when they're reaching their term limit. However, we know from Barack Obama's, I think his capstone may very well be a total reworking of our constitutional system of government.
Well,
of learning to work without Congress, or getting the mainly apathetic American public, and I'm just going to be quite honest, folks, and if it stings, then maybe you need to go figure out what's wrong. The vast majority of the apathetic American public really won't care as long as it's not affecting them, it's not happening in their backyard, or they're getting something out of it. Hey, you know what? Obamacare is horrible until I get a subsidy. And then once I get subsidy, then, hey, I'm all for it. You know, it's just like education. Private education is great, but as soon as they start subsidizing some over the others, then pretty soon the non-subsidized can't compete anymore.
Well, Barry, you know, when we teach our class on the Constitution, our Institute on the Constitution class, and we have two of them going right now, one is still early enough that you can get in on it. The other one's pretty late. You don't want to jump in too late. And you can see it on the website, principledpolicy.com. One of the things that we do is teach out of a book called Restoring America, One County at a Time. And what's the key phrase that comes up in every chapter of that book? If you want your freedom back,
don't take the cheese.
Don't take the cheese. And that's exactly what is being talked about here. He's going to put his, he's going to bait the traps with as much cheese as he can put out there. And the fact is that people are taking the cheese from the trap all the time. Don't even realize it. You know, we all joke about the third rail of American politics, which is Social Security.
Social Security, that's right.
Never touch the third rail. But the fact is that that's cheese. And it's been around since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the, and what Barack Obama wants is to be talked about in the same kind of sentences and odd tones that FDR gets talked about in. Even in, Barry, this is very disappointing to me, and this is one thing that makes me, when I was doing homeschooling, we used to look at history curricula, and even in good Christian homeschool curricula, you'd find FDR, all these wonderful things FDR did to help all these people. FDR helped no one. FDR extended, took a serious financial downturn that should have lasted about 2 years, had no one meddled with it. And expanded it into a 10-year nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the fact is that you look at a lot of curricula and you'll see, oh, he did this. You know, he instituted this program, that program, another program. And in fact, we just asked a Constitution question of our students in our.
And it's okay to say what it is because they'll have to answer before this show
right.
airs.
We asked a question about a seizure of power that Barack Obama did early in his administration, and that was the Labor Department came out and sued an aircraft company that wanted to move from the state of Washington to South Carolina.
Right.
And the reason they wanted to do that was because they could build aircraft cheaper there. Because they didn't have all the regulatory labor issues to deal with, the union-based labor issues. Well, what did the Labor Department, you're trying to bypass labor law, and therefore it's illegal. Folks, there is nowhere in the United States Constitution where any department of government is empowered with telling a corporation where it can and cannot do business for any reason.
But, Charles, it's good to be the king, and the king has divine right. The king can tell anybody to do whatever they want to. You work here, and you stop working there, and you make this for us, and you can sell that to them, but not to them. Isn't that what power is all about?
Well, not the ones constrained by the Constitution.
Ah, see, there's the rub. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We go back to it is written, the word. The document that lays out our form of government, that is the operator's manual for how to run that government. See, that's the beauty of the Constitution, folks. It isn't that it's divinely inspired, which it's not, by the way. So let's get that out of our heads right now. Our founders were not angels. They were men, because if men were angels, then no government would be necessary.
Definitely fallible.
They're definitely fallible and definitely sinful, and they understood sin. That's the reason why the Constitution is structured the way it is.
Exactly.
But the document has specific words which give specific powers and limits those powers to specific branches of the government to do certain things. And everything else that's not mentioned in there, 14th Amendment notwithstanding, is reserved to the states or to the people. That's the 10th Amendment. It's also Article 4, Article 6.
Right.
Article. I mean, you can go down the pike with this. What we have now, and we're going to talk about this here in a second, because not only does Obama not have time because the clock's ticking, he has a radical reinterpretation of his constitutional authority because he doesn't want to be bound by the words of this document either. Congress doesn't want to be bound by the words of this document because they want to have power to reach in and tell somebody you can't grow grain for your own pigs, that's
Wickard versus Filburn.
They want to tell people you can't hunt in your own state because we've done a treaty with some other country on migratory waterfowl. That's the Missouri v. Holland case.
Missouri v. Holland, yeah.
And the courts have been complicit in this by basically making themselves a party to the actions because the honor of the court is at stake if they rule in a certain way. So they ignore, and, you know, we just read this with our other class the other night in an article by Joe Sobrand that was written 20 years ago, that what the courts have really done, both in the abortion cases, the Planned Parenthood and Roe v. Wade, and now in the
Obamacare decision,
is they've made themselves an active party to the disagreement and decided that the merits of the two sides really didn't matter. What mattered was the honor of the court and how they looked. And that's how they ruled. And folks, if you want to challenge us on this, please do, because we'll show you where they've done
this. We'll point it out.
We'll point it out.
No problem.
But the key is, if our elected officials are not willing to be bound, and they take an oath to say that they will, are not willing to be bound by the words and the limitations of the document that is the governing and construction document for our form of government, and that has served us over, Sheila Jackson Lee, not 400 years, but about 225 years, then, ladies and gentlemen, we don't have a constitution problem. And Chuck and I have said this before. We have a representation problem. We have constitutional illiteracy and ignorance and out-and-out disdain, because it's just their opinion that matters. It's their preferences. It's their policy wants. It's their legacies are the only thing that matter. The document itself doesn't matter, and what you feel about the document sure doesn't matter. What you feel about their priorities and their procedures and their policies really doesn't matter. It's when we start holding them to account with the specifics of the document that they swear an oath before God and the public that they are going to uphold and defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Until that day comes when we stop with the excuses about, oh, the guy in the other party's worse.
Yes.
Or, oh, everybody's bad except my guy, and my guy walks on water. Or, well, you know what? Yeah, he was a rookie. He made a rookie mistake on this one, and then that one, and then this one, and then that bill, and then this bill. Or he's kind of in a rough district, and if he doesn't go along with the caucus, then they won't support him for re-election. Folks, those are all rationalizations and excuses. Who's living in idealism land? Who's living in fantasy world now? If we don't start saying, excuse me, it's written right here, you swore an oath, you violated that oath, you've done something against this Constitution, which makes you an enemy to this Constitution, which makes you an enemy to the people who ordained and established this Constitution. Because what does the preamble of the Constitution say, Chuck? We the people do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
You have to know what the words mean, too.
You got to know what the words mean.
An ordination is an endowment with
authority. Authority. And ordain and endow are basically just reiterate. Remember how in Scripture, if God wants you to really remember something, he repeats himself? Well, the people kind of repeated themselves. It's like, we are ordaining. No, we are endowing you. So if you want to like play fast and loose with words and do postmodernism, we're going to cover you on both ends of it. Ordain and endow means that you got authority, but the only place you got it from is us. It's not divine right of kings. It's not dictatorship. It's certain not oligarchy. And yes, because we're a constitutional representative republic, it's certainly not pure democracy.
That's right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we have to be vigilant. We have to stand guard, because if we don't, this is what can happen. And this comes from an article that was written by our friend Phyllis Schlafly in Investors Business Daily's investor.com, where she headlines it, "The President Makes a Grab for Dictatorial Power." Remember I told you about the 'tis true, 'tis pity? Here it is, ladies and gentlemen. Phyllis Schlafly writes, "The U.S. is at a constitutional tipping point and, quote, in the midst of a constitutional crisis." How long have we been saying that, Chuck? A while now. Okay. "Has President Obama unilaterally overturned the constitutional framework of three branches that is the basis of our unique and successful system of self-government? That question's not just partisan bickering by Republicans and Tea Party activists. It was spoken in all seriousness in testimony before the House Judiciary Committee by a distinguished constitutional law professor who voted for Obama."
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Turley, law professor from George Washington University, went in front of Congress here about a week and a half ago, Chuck, and he basically said that there is a massive gravitational shift of authority to the executive branch. Now, Chuck, I know that some people don't understand this document the way we understand it, because we've immersed ourselves in it for now. I mean, between the two of us, I think it's about 80 years worth of joint study of this document and all things constitutional and political.
Yep.
How's the only way that one of the branches can end up grabbing more power and have a quote-unquote gravitational shift of authority to one branch? What's the only means by that happening?
Usurpation.
But how? Can they just do it? Yes, the president could declare martial law tomorrow and roll the military into the halls of Congress and arrest every one of the congressmen, but he doesn't have to do that because what happened?
Because the Congress laid down and let him do it.
Capitulation. And because, if you remember, I don't know if it was Alexander Hamilton or James Madison in one of the Federalist Papers said that the only way you could end up with a despotism was when one of the branches decided to share authority and commingle their authority with one of the others. And that's the way the thing gets out of balance. Now, what's been happening? Congress has been rolling over and letting the president do what he wants to do. The courts have been grabbing their own constitutional power from Congress and pushing it toward the president. I mean, obviously, John Roberts' decision in the Obamacare ruling was a classic textbook example of just that kind of thing. The court is going to determine what Congress really meant and say that, well, they used this word, but they really meant this idea instead, even when there's documentation to say, no, we meant exactly what we said we meant. Oh, no, you didn't mean that. You had to have meant this. And what it did was it gave a massive shift of power to the executive branch.
Well, what you described is exactly how phrases like separation of church and state have been read into the Constitution.
Yes.
When you get someone who comes in and talks to you about separation of church and state being in the Constitution, if you take our class, you'll get a little, free little copy, and you can open it up and say, okay, well, here it is. Show me where.
That's right.
Show me where. And they'll say the First Amendment, and you read the First Amendment, nothing like that is in the First Amendment. Yeah. This is how it happens. You get somebody 200 years after the fact that digs up a letter that was written by Thomas Jefferson to a private group who was asking him to intervene against a state government in their favor. And he said, I can't do that.
That's right. See, most people don't even realize that letter to the Danbury Baptists was about them asking the federal government to come in and force their will on the state.
Exactly.
You know, because that's been mischaracterized throughout history and throughout our classes that, oh, these poor downtrodden, they were asking the federal government to put a wall of separation between the federal government and the church. No, they were asking for the federal government power to come down and smack their state so that they could get a preference.
Exactly.
That's what the Danbury letter was all about. And, of course, the courts then in later decisions grabbed that letter and said, oh, look, precedent.
But not until when? 1947. That thing popped up. It was an obscure little letter.
So 1803 to 1947, you can do the math, 144 years. It took them 144 years and a change in philosophical frameworks in our country. A major change in philosophical frameworks from Christian Republic to basically empire, based on democracy, and then the advent of getting away from absolute standards and absolute definitions to relativity and to basically what gets down, well, some would call it modernism at that point in the 1940s, but it's really postmodernism, which was really around since the 19-teens. So you had a whole worldview, theological, philosophical, sociological shift in that 144 years, which allowed those justices to grab a letter written in 1803 and say, oh, we can twist this the way we want to get our policy preference to become the law of the land.
And that's exactly what, basically, a staffer, a clerk, was sent out to find something to give them an excuse.
Yep.
That's exactly what happened. And you can read that in David Barton's original intent. He talks about the case. I think it's Everson v. Walls.
Yes, I believe it was the Everson case.
And essentially, yeah. Somebody was, go out and find me something that can support. I want to come to this decision. Go out and find me the paperwork I need to support this decision.
Yep. Now, Professor Turley here, I want to grab back at this just for a quick second. He says something that, although in part is true, I think he even misses a little bit of the depth of the problem. And he says this about this massive gravitational shift. He says, we can point to a few moves in that direction under previous presidents. Well, more than a few moves. But that's not the one I'm taking umbrage to. But the current shift of power is proceeding, quote, at an alarming rate, and while, and just as ominous, the other branches, Congress and the courts, are, quote, mute and passive, unquote, in the face of Obama's unprecedented expansion of executive branch power. That's where I take umbrage with Professor Turley. No, neither one of those two branches are mute and passive. They are both vocal and active participants in helping it to go that direction. Why would John Boehner force his finance committee leadership members to vote in favor of an open-ended, uncapped debt ceiling to give to President Obama during a midterm election? That's not mute and passive.
No.
That's actively saying we're ceding the ground and we're going to hand over power to you to do what you feel like doing. Oh, but we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, too, because there's a little measure here that Obama's going to basically rule unconstitutional and refuse to sign it and veto it, which kind of really is the hammering home point of everything we're talking about here today. But I think Professor Turley may be a little bit too idealistic in how he's framing this, because Congress and the courts have been anything but mute. I mean, the courts have been very, very vocal. When you can say that a fee is a tax in order to make it constitutional and give Congress the authority to implement it, because they wouldn't have the authority, it wouldn't be constitutional otherwise. If you said that these penalties were a penalty, fee was a penalty instead of a tax, they don't have the constitutional authority to do so. But somehow, if you change the definition of words, as the Chief Justice did in his opinion, then it falls under Article 1, Section 8, because Congress has the power to tax, even when Congress themselves submitted documentation saying, no, this is not, and the administration submitted documentation saying it's not a tax, it's a fee, penalty.
And what's funny about that is they submitted all that documentation and all the argumentation in order to save the bill, because they assumed that if Roberts found that was a tax,
they were done.
They were done, because
the Congress has the power to tax, but the bill has to originate, because it would be an appropriations measure at that point.
That's right.
And the bill would have to originate in the House of Representatives per the Constitution. Going back to what's written. Oh, my goodness. We have to go back. But where was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act? That was Senate bill. Started in the Senate.
Yep.
And now if it were a penalty, Chuck, it could start in the Senate, because then it's not an appropriations measure. But if it's a tax, then it becomes an appropriation, and appropriations have to start in the House. So in order to save the honor of the court from all this public pressure, John Roberts created a new constitutional crisis by basically cutting the knees out from under Congress and calling a non-tax a tax in order to make it constitutional, and thus making the bill and its process unconstitutional. But I guess we're going to ignore that, because really we don't have to read those words in the Constitution anymore, because, well, it's a bill and it started in Congress and Senate's part of Congress, and so therefore it could start anywhere. Oh, no, wait a minute. But I guess the tax is not an appropriation. Yep. Wow. How much of the dictionary are we going to have to rewrite in order to satisfy the courts and the Obama administration?
But what else is new? It's all about the court has been spent years, since the early part of the Republic, redefining words so that they fit in the framework that they're trying to build around the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
This is nothing new. And the fact is that it's not going to stop until basically Congress takes the reins and takes the power that they have been given in the Constitution.
But they're not going to do that.
No, they're not.
Because, again, this is where politics plays in, ladies and gentlemen. And we're going from being idealists to being realists here, because, again, you know, Chuck and I are trying to get rid of that ugly misnomer that we're idealists. The reason why Congress is going to cede all that authority to the executive, to the president, is because then when it goes wrong, they can blame him politically and they can score points and they can get votes out of it. But if they do it and it goes bad, he gets that political game chit.
You know, if you're familiar with the Federalist Papers, this is exactly why Madison was against what he called faction.
Right, which he meant party.
Party.
Political party.
Yeah, because this is clearly playing party politics, hardball party politics, rather than what's good for the republic, what's good for the party.
Oh, of course. And that's all this has been about. That's the reason why John Boehner capitulated, because he was afraid of getting tarred and feathered in elections, figuratively, not literally, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Let me make sure I make that clear. He was afraid of getting figuratively tarred and feathered in the upcoming midterm elections if we shut down government again. Oh, my goodness. We would shut down. Now, Chuck, if you remember that quote-unquote slowdown, shutdown thing we had that lasted about 3 weeks, nobody lost any money.
You mean the paid vacation
for
federal workers?
The paid vacation for federal workers, because they all got the full back pay, and I don't even think they had to take vacation time for it.
No, they didn't.
So, folks, ladies and gentlemen, you got hit twice. It's like double taxation. Oh, well, that's a new concept in this country, isn't it? I'm sorry. I have got my cynic on today.
Yeah, it's that's usually my hat.
Yeah, no, I'm running it today. Okay, but Turley goes on to talk about Obama and the reason why he's now upset at the man he voted for. Now, it doesn't say how many times he voted for him. He might have voted for him twice, and I'd almost guess he did. But he says here that, you know, and one of the examples he uses is the war-making powers, that the Constitution gives the authority to make war to Congress. We know that clearly from Article 1, Section 8, and Article 2, where the president's made commander-in-chief. He says, now here, Obama thinks he can make a, quote, unilateral commitment of our country to war. And Phyllis Schlafly goes on to explain this. She says, Turley explained that Obama, quote, funded an entire military campaign in Libya by shifting billions in money and equipment without asking Congress for a dollar, unquote. And that's exactly what happened, ladies and gentlemen. He just transferred the money from another account, boasting that he, quote, alone would define what is a war, unquote. Wow, ladies and gentlemen, that sounds like John Kasich here in Ohio. I get the right to define what conservatism is in our state. Obama gets the right to define what a war is or isn't and what can be done about it. The Constitution be hanged. Congress? War? No. I've got the power of the pen. I'll just shift money here and put billions into this and send planes and troops and advisors and other things, but I don't have to go to Congress for that because I know what a war is, and I'm defining that as not a war. Folks, we're living in a constitutional crisis that daily has another chapter being added to it.
And,
daily.
And it's not. It wouldn't be so bad if it was a little thing here and a little thing there. It'd be bad enough. These are major. These are not baby steps. These are big daddy steps.
Well, remember, the clock's ticking, Chuck. We don't have time to waste.
Exactly.
Okay? And, folks, you should be paying attention to that. Now, Schlafly goes on quoting some more things here. Says, Obama is eager to get federal mitts on school curriculum so that the screws can be tightened on what kids learn and, just as important, what they do not learn, i.e. like the Constitution.
Right.
The previous law to attempt to control education, No Child Left Behind, or as we like to call it, the Kennedy-Boehner Bill.
Right, the Kennedy-Boehner Act.
Yeah, Kennedy-Boehner Act, because those were the two prime sponsors, Teddy Kennedy in the Senate and John Boehner in the House, didn't fit into his plan, so he just nullified it by a series of unilateral waivers and is now welcoming nationalization of curriculum by Common Core. Folks, why do you think we're fighting Common Core in Ohio? Because that's exactly what it is. No Child Left Behind put all these schools behind the eight ball. Obama comes in like the knight riding the shining horse and with all the armor polished, writes them all waivers and gives them money to implement Common Core. And so guess what? Schools are lining up. States are lining up to get all this money. I guess John Kasich must think that this is our money to begin with, so we should get it back. Sorry.
Yeah.
Bad idea. Okay. When Obama, in his State of the Union address, this is Schlafly continuing, announced he would take unilateral action, quote, with or without Congress, and he did say that, and it's on tape.
Yes, he did.
Turley expected an outcry from his congressional audience, but that didn't happen. Where was Joe Uli Wilson when we needed him to call out, you are unconstitutional? Well, he'd been muzzled, of course, because he did that the year before in the state of the state.
And was, I'm guessing, was severely admonished by the Speaker of the House.
By John Boehner, that's right. And he says, Turley points out, Congress is becoming marginalized by hundreds of thousands of regulations that are promulgated without direct congressional action and outside the system created by the framers. Funny, Chuck, and I think we've mentioned this before, didn't Thomas Jefferson make a little point of this as one of the reasons for separation from Great Britain? That they have sent forth swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Folks, those officers were bureaucrats. He was talking about the colonial governors who were appointed by the crown and the colonial tax agents and all of those who were appointed and answered directly to the chief executive, not to the people. Folks, Turley's basically reiterating the Declaration of Independence's points here. Folks, we're 243 years from when they penned that. Did it really?
242.
Yeah, you're right. 242. I apologize.
Quick math.
I'm not good at quick math today. I'm never good at quick math. Who am I kidding? But Turley's really kind of pointing out this. His speech, honestly, is our second declaration's points of the reasons for the separation from this current government. I hate to say it that way, but that's really what it's looking like. Turley, spelling out the problem further, says, quote, a fourth branch has emerged in our tripartite system. The vast majority of laws, and he puts it in quotation marks, are not passed by Congress. This, quote, has accelerated at an alarming rate and caused a massive gravitational shift. And he brings up Obamacare. And the Dream Act that Obama implemented by executive order and not by
because he couldn't get it through Congress.
And cap and trade. So Obama has created the regulations of greenhouse gases that were the core of the cap and trade program that he couldn't get through Congress. He ordered U.S. attorneys to stop prosecuting nonviolent drug crime defendants, which negated congressional sentencing provisions. Changed the meaning of the Wire Act, which had prohibited internet gambling. But now you can go online and play the cards and the ponies. Obama, part of his prime duty, and I think this is where Schlafly really hits her high point here, that the prime duty of the president is to, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That's part of his oath of office.
Article 2.
It's part of the Constitution. It's part of his oath. But Obama refused to faithfully execute the Defense of Marriage Act, which had been overwhelmingly passed by Congress and signed by former President Bill Clinton. And Obama instructed Attorney General Eric Holder not to defend DOMA in court, and then Holder told all states' attorneys general not to defend the marriage laws in their own states. Now, that Turley sums it up by saying, quote, Obama has knowingly and repeatedly violated the Constitution. Charles, that language are the grounds for articles of impeachment.
Okay, yes. And since we're going to end up being short on time for something I wanted to do today, let's go over to this. There is a bill before Congress.
Yes, there is.
And what it is designed to do is allow Congress to, quote unquote, sue the president if he refuses to follow the law. To sue him?
They already have that power. It's called impeachment.
Impeachment.
It's impeachment.
It's not just sue. It's try. Now, there is nothing stopping Congress from filing suit against the President of the United States.
Where would it be heard? The impeachment would start in the House of Representatives.
Well, no. I'm talking about even just filing a suit to force him to enforce the law. Where would that be heard?
It would have to be heard in the United States Supreme Court.
It's the only court that has original jurisdiction. Forget district court. Forget circuit court. Forget all that. None of those count. The Constitution is clear. Article 3 is clear. That's an original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. Now, if the Supreme Court should fail to order the president to uphold the law,
yes,
then what? Well, it seems to me...
Then that means that if the court ruled that way And since the courts are the one who now make laws, according to everybody who believe Roe v. Wade's the law of the land, then whatever the president does then becomes new constitutional writ.
And what's the real constitutional solution?
Impeachment and expulsion, and then if those acts raise to a criminal level, tried in civil court after he's removed from office.
Ladies and gentlemen, we run into situations all the time where we talk to people and who really believe that the courts are the final arbiters of what the Constitution says. This is nonsense. There are two groups that are the final arbiters of what the Constitution says: the states and the people, because of Article 10.
That's right.
Of the Bill of Rights. In other words, the 10th Amendment. Those powers are reserved to the people and to the states. And the fact is that this law that Congress is... I'll tell you, the House will pass it. The Senate will refuse to pass it. That would basically allow the Congress to sue the president if he doesn't obey the law. They don't need to pass a law, first of all. Second of all, this puts Obama in the driver's seat because he can veto the law, which he would.
Well, let's just entertain. Okay, maybe I'm slipping back into idealism here, but I'm looking at it from a realistic standpoint. They're passing all these other laws that he's just basically flat out ignoring. What makes them think he won't just ignore this one and say, go ahead?
Yeah, sue me.
Sue me.
Exactly. He'll refuse to comply.
And then his attorneys will send a memorandum to the Supreme Court quashing the suit by saying that they don't have the standing to do so.
Exactly. The fact is that Boehner and company need to pull their head out of the sand on these constitutional crises. And you know what it is? It's cowardice. Again, it's party politics leading to cowardice.
This is political gamesmanship, ladies and gentlemen. I don't care who introduced the bill. I don't care that the fact that you had 233 members sign on to it and vote on it, including five Democrats. This is all window dressing for the midterm elections. Folks, honestly, you ought to send a great letter to any of these 233 congressmen and saying, oh, so now you've decided to abandon the Constitution and violate your own oath of office to say that he's violating his oath and abandoning the Constitution, so you'll sue him for that. What's our response as constituents? Honestly, we have the right to impeach, too. It's called voting them out of office.
Well, the idea that you would sue in the Supreme Court...
But it's not in the Supreme Court. That's the problem with this resolution. This Enforce the Law Act, sponsored by Trey Gowdy, who is fairly conservative from South Carolina, basically provides a quote-unquote expedited process through the federal district courts, meaning Trey Gowdy doesn't even understand
the
Constitution.
The fact is, what this does tacitly is say that everything in the Constitution, there's a question about it, and we need the courts to decide.
The courts have to tell us what the Constitution says, which is what the courts have been trying to get the unilateral and permanent power to do since Marbury v. Madison.
It's a completely false reading of the powers of the court in Article 3. The fact is that they already have the power, A, to sue, if you want to go through that rigmarole, but that's not where they should be going. Once the president ignites a constitutional crisis by refusing to uphold his oath of office, he is in violation of his oath, which means he's in violation of the highest law of the land.
That's exactly
now,
right.
Now, there are, that is actually, if you think about it, Barry, refusal to enforce is one of the checks and balances. But it's supposed to ignite a constitutional crisis so it can be hashed out. The fact is that Boehner and company, Boehner and the boys, who, remember, the House indicts and the Senate tries in an impeachment.
I do believe we've been pronouncing his last name wrong. I believe it's Boehner because he must be French.
He must be French. And that's an insult to the French. There are a lot of French people I actually kind of like.
No, I like French. But the French is a government and the French is a military power and the French is a strategic planning power. Not so much.
I'm especially fond of Frédéric Bastiat. After reading his book umpteen times.
Well, I'm especially fond of the French Huguenots, so that's
okay. The Huguenots, yeah. But in any case, it's supposed to ignite a constitutional crisis, and they're not taking advantage of that and protecting the republic and protecting our liberty by doing what they are empowered to do, and that is trying the president, indicting him, and trying him.
Okay, Chuck, I've got one for you, and this is out of the article. I know you and I are
do it quick. We're almost out of time.
This by Elizabeth Harrington in the Washington Free Beacon. House passes Enforce the Law Act. At the very end, there's a quote from Trey Gowdy, who's a congressman from South Carolina. And he says, quote, "I taught the Constitution for 10 years. I believe in the Constitution," unquote. Congressman Gowdy, you need to go back and reread the Constitution.
You need to go back.
Because the Enforce the Law Act is absolutely, unquestionably not constitutional.
No, it's not. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we'll ask you to join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.